migration many times. Up until the 1970s, most Mexican Americans viewed immigrants as a huge problem. Why? When immigrants arrived in the United States, they were cast as bringing disease, bringing crime, just like nowadays. And so Mexican Americans had an option. They could, and one of these options was to say, look, we are not them. We don't want them here. If they don't come, we won't be stereotyped as criminals. We won't be stereotyped as bringing in disease. Stop them from coming. So this was a very common speech and rhetoric of the Mexican-American community up until the 1970s. This type of rhetoric began to change because of the civil rights movement. Because of the civil rights movement of the 1960s, when Mexican-Americans said, actually, these people are our brethren. We are still being discriminated. Instead of stopping their discrimination, instead of fighting for them not to come, let us say they should not be discriminated either.
Ana Raquel Miñon, we have to leave it there, and we thank you so much for being with us. Associate Professor of History at Stanford University, author of In the Shadow of Liberty, The Invisible History of Immigrant Detention in the United States. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new mayor-elect for the city of Portland. Washington's new governor-elect promises to protect his citizens from illegal actions by the incoming Trump administration. And Oregon Democrats celebrate several congressional wins. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 7th, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Keith Wilson is set to be the next mayor of Portland. A second drop of ballots last night confirmed Wilson's victory with 62% of the vote. City Commissioner Carmen Rubio was his last standing opponent, and she conceded and congratulated Wilson yesterday. He's a newcomer to Portland's politics, but not to Portland itself. Wilson spoke with KBOO's Lenita Duke on an episode of Running on Air ahead of the election.
I remember a time in Portland when African-American family in inner northeast Portland couldn't get a mortgage to refinance their home to, you know, increase the value of it. And then you have those same homes now worth $500,000 and close to $1 million.
Yeah.
It depends on who you are, how Portland looks.
You know, when you say that, it's really interesting. So I grew up in deep north Portland. So we are in the poorest zip code in Portland. I grew up next to the Columbia Villa.
Okay, so and you grew up in north Portland.
I know when you say gentrification and displacement, mm-hmm. I lived it every day. We grew up poor. There was seven of us in a 900 square foot home. You know, mom was an Avon lady, dad delivered luggage, lost luggage from the airport. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they struggled. My father nor my brothers graduated from high school. So when you think about opportunities, those that had and those that had not, I certainly understand and can sympathize to some degree with you, Lenita. Your personal experiences are certainly different than mine. But going back to your question, why am I running? You know, one of the moments, it just was an epiphany, is in North Portland, you know, it's one of the poorer communities, and Roosevelt was one of the more disadvantaged high schools.
One of Wilson's biggest campaign promises is to end unsheltered homelessness in Portland by 2026. He plans to do this by opening up overnight shelters in buildings that are not in use during the night.
According to you, you want to end unsheltered homelessness within a year of being elected.
Yeah.
That's pretty revolutionary.
Yeah. You know, it's not based on hope. It's based on research. So I researched and I've been traveling around the nation working with mayors and county officials and federal officials. President Obama's Assistant Secretary to Reduce Homelessness is on my team. The mayor of Boise, who ended unsheltered homelessness, is on my team, and a host of others. And with their help, we've done the research. We've gathered a national team and it's backed up with executive directors from some of our city's largest homeless service providers. We started opening shelters so we could test, find out the costing, and we created a roadmap. And then with my executive experience, I've got the ability to successfully see the project through. And I founded a nonprofit called Shelter Portland. And that's the kind of central location where we allow all of our information, our research, our visits to be a repository. And then I always want people to go to that and look at the research tab. You will see a clearly delineated budget on the costs we came up with, the flow of individuals that we need, how many beds should we provide, and then an overall cost to end unsheltered homelessness.
And that was Portland Mayor-elect Keith Wilson speaking about his plans to end unsheltered homelessness within a year of taking office. Wilson will be the first mayor elected in Portland's new system of government. This means he won't have as much of a legislative role and will instead focus on running city bureaus alongside the city administrator. And the results for the voting for Portland City Council are becoming more clear. While the votes are still being tallied, multiple rounds of voting are taking place to figure out the three winners from each of the four districts. Candidates who receive at least 25% plus one of the first choice votes automatically get a seat on the council. In District 1, the current leaders are nonprofit executive Candace Avalos, former Multnomah County Commissioner Loretta Smith, and former city advisor Jamie Dunphy. In District 2, the current leaders are City Commissioner Dan Ryan, policy consultant Elena Pertle-Guinney, and former city employee Samir Canal. In District 3, the current leaders are former Commissioner Steve Novick, teacher Tiffany Coya-Mullane, and policy advocate Angelita Murillo. And in District 4, the leaders are legislative advocate Olivia Clark, economist Mitch Green, and County Commission employee Eric Zimmerman. There are roughly 100,000 votes left to count. The county is going to release another counting update tonight. Another election night winner, Washington's new governor-elect, Democrat Bob Ferguson, defeated former Congressman and Republican Dave Reichert. Ferguson is the state's current attorney general, and he pledges as governor he will continue to protect Washingtonians from President-elect Trump's administration.
I'll be very clear. There is nobody running for statewide office this year anywhere in the United States who is more prepared to defend your freedoms against that administration than I am.
Ferguson says during Trump's first term, he stood up for the rights of Washingtonians harmed by the Trump administration, blocking more than 50 illegal policies, including what he calls Trump's immoral and unconstitutional Muslim travel bans. Oregon's Governor Tina Kotek had a message for Oregonians about the election.
I know we're all feeling the weight of the moment following the results. Regardless of who you supported in the elections, it's important to affirm that our democracy is strong and public service professionals across our country worked hard to ensure a safe, fair election. I particularly want to thank Oregon's county clerks and their staff and volunteers for their work leading up to Election Day and the work they're going to be doing in the coming days. If you feel the need to exercise your right to freedom of political expression and freedom of assembly, I ask that you do so peacefully and lawfully. I have zero tolerance for actions that threaten and terrorize others. My office is closely monitoring and coordinating with local, state, and federal agencies to ensure communities and businesses remain safe and unharmed during these tense times. Oregonians have shown they will continue to lead with compassion, courage, and conviction, protecting a place where everyone can be themselves, feel welcome, and have equal opportunity to a healthy, prosperous life. We will continue to march forward and stand together as a shield against any attempt to undermine our fundamental freedoms. Our laws, our policies, and our actions will remain a deterrent to any attacks on our values and our democracy. In the friendships I've fostered across our beautiful state since becoming your governor, I know that good people in every corner are working tirelessly to shape a better future for their families and communities. Let's build on this shared resolve and stay committed to collaboration for the common good. We are strong, resilient, and united by our shared belief in a brighter tomorrow. And as your governor, I will always have your back and work hard to uplift and protect our wonderful state boldly and with perseverance in partnership with other elected and community leaders. Thank you.
Again, that was Oregon Governor Tina Kotek.
People do fear for themselves and their families.
Washington's current longtime Democratic Governor Jay Inslee says the state is prepared if the Trump administration tries to act on mass deportations or withholding funding as a threat for transportation and climate change programs.
Not under the law, that would be illegal.
And Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell says his executive team is already talking about the city's reliance on federal resources and has set aside money for immigrants and refugees' legal needs.
I wouldn't say Seattle's an outlier. I'd say that the elected President Trump had a message that resonated in a lot of the swing states. Our values don't change. Our vision should not be centered around one person.
Oregon's Democratic congressional delegation had a good election night overall, with Suzanne Bonamici, Maxine Dexter, Val Hoyle, and Andrea Salinas winning their races. Here's part of Salinas' victory speech.
Oregon Democrats are the party of inclusivity. We mean it when we say every vote matters, and no one, absolutely no one, gets left behind. So no matter what happens tonight to the top of the ticket, I am heartened by the fact that here in Oregon, we have made our voices heard loud and clear for democracy and for our futures. Oregonians want leaders who will keep extreme politicians out of their doctor's offices and vote to restore our reproductive freedom at the federal level. We want leaders who will tackle the mental health and addiction crisis head on, working with anybody who is willing to work with us to build a diverse and thriving workforce, expand access to affordable treatment, and make our communities safer while connecting more Oregonians with the care and help they need and deserve. We will make life affordable again for working and middle-class families. We want leaders who are tireless when they want to bring down the cost of gas, groceries, and housing. We will protect your hard-earned benefits and bring millions of dollars of hard-earned taxpayer money back to Oregon. Tonight, the people of Oregon have spoken, and they have thankfully once again chosen me to represent them in the 6th District and be their champion. I am honored. Thank you. I am so honored and humbled to continue to serve you and your neighbors in Congress. And I want you to know I am going back to D.C. to fight like hell. Let's keep working. Thank you.
Another Oregon Democrat, Janelle Bynum, is leading in her race versus incumbent Republican Lori Chavez de Remer. And in Washington's 3rd Congressional District, Democrat Marie Glusenkamp-Perez is also leading over Republican Joe Kent. Oregon Republican Congressman Cliff Bentz easily won re-election. Today, Multnomah County Sheriff Nicole Morrissey O'Donnell made her case to Multnomah County Commissioners that her law enforcement department's in a state of crisis and not able to keep up with the demand to hire more people. She's asking the commission for extra funding of about $1 million to help fix the problems.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to request the board's approval of a budget modification to address MCSO's persistent staffing and recruitment challenges. This has proven to have been a significant impact across our corrections division, resulting in multiple system concerns, ranging from booking and housing area post-closures, over-reliance on overtime, which creates staff burnout and low morale, and the inability to be flexible in addressing the jail capacity as the population increases. This is a complicated and challenging time where MCSO staffing shortfalls collide with an increase in jail use in Multnomah County. As our local public safety agencies make adjustments and begin to lift out of their staffing challenges, we naturally see an increase in law enforcement's ability to address calls for service, engage in self-initiated activity, along with added presence in our communities. This results in higher levels of booking activity. While we still have adults in our custody for very significant charges related to ballot measure 11 who have much longer lengths of stay. To clarify further, the Sheriff's Office correction system is essentially the central wheel where the successful movement of processes is paramount to not delay or grind the whole criminal justice system to a halt. An example is that Multnomah County continues to struggle to reduce court process delays for several reasons, one of which is our corrections deputy vacancies that directly impact MCSO's court services unit. This unit of deputies is responsible to facilitate court movement of adults in custody and provide a presence in the court hearings. When court services deputies are limited, court proceedings may be delayed or they may even be canceled. Over the last few years, you have heard from the Sheriff's Office related to our growing staffing crisis and the need for a properly funded and staffed human resources unit. As the crisis has continued to grow, the impacts across our organization have become more expansive, and this has culminated in an acute sense of urgency to act upon this request to address this trend. In 2021 and 22, nearly half of the entire corrections workforce separated, in part due to large numbers of retirements stemming from the extensive hiring pushes that we were doing in the 1990s. While our HR unit has worked diligently to hire corrections deputies, this has now led to hiring delays in other areas of the agency.
That was Multnomah County Sheriff Nicole Morrissey O'Donnell today speaking to Multnomah County commissioners. In California, the election brought a blow to criminal justice reform, as Suzanne Potter reports that it's due to the passage of Proposition 36, which is likely to put more people in jail and less money into crime-fighting programs.
Advocates of criminal justice reform warn the passage of Proposition 36 will mean a sharp reduction in funds to anti-crime initiatives. The measure raises the penalties for certain drug and theft crimes, making more of them felonies that carry jail time. Will Matthews with the nonprofit Californians for Safety and Justice says voters were fed false promises that Prop 36 would reduce property crime by forcing more people to choose between treatment and incarceration.
It really was a disingenuous initiative that now will result in billions of dollars being diverted away from treating addiction, treating mental illness, and helping folks coming home from a period of incarceration.
Prop 36 repeals parts of Proposition 47, which funneled the savings from reduced prison costs into programs designed to combat poverty and addiction, the root causes of crime. Political science professor Christopher Hallenbrook with Cal State Dominguez Hills agrees that Prop 36 will cost the state hundreds of millions, money that will be diverted from anti-crime initiatives.
There's no way you can pass 36 and not put more people in jail. The more money you're spending on incarceration, the less money you're spending on other things. That is definitely an accurate assessment of Prop 36 and seems to be one that voters decided they were okay with.
Prop 36 was largely funded by retail giants such as Home Depot, Target, and Walmart, hoping that the prospect of higher penalties will deter retail crime.
Meantime, experts are analyzing why California propositions on raising the minimum wage and rent control both failed.
California political analysts say inflation and voter confusion contributed to the failure of propositions to raise the minimum wage and allow stronger rent control. Proposition 33 would have allowed local governments to pass strict new rent control ordinances. Professor Christian Gross at the University of Southern California's Dornsife College and Price School of Public Policy says voters may have found the measure to be overly complex.
We did some polling on this back in September, and we found a lot of people were undecided. So I think it's a confusing initiative for a lot of voters, and so often when people aren't certain what the effects are going to be, they'll just vote no.
Opponents of Prop 33 argued that more rent control would discourage construction of new rental units, thus thwarting attempts to increase the supply of housing. Proposition 32 would have raised the minimum wage to $18 an hour for companies that have 26 or more employees, and to $17 an hour for smaller companies. Gross says the defeat is surprising, as California recently raised the minimum wage, but only for fast food workers.
I think with inflation, there's some concerns about raising minimum wage will then lead to increased costs. So people who traditionally would support minimum wage maybe are opposed. There have been increases in minimum wage, so that might have been in the back of people's minds as well.
Opponents of Prop 32 warned it would have hurt California businesses and led to an increase in the cost of goods and services. Keely O'Brien with the Western Center on Law and Poverty says Prop 32 would have helped the working poor at a time when poverty is the highest it has been in years.
In early 2023, 31% of California residents were either poor or near poor, and nearly 76% of poor Californians lived in families with at least one working adult. They're often working really hard, and they still don't have the resources that they need.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, a few clouds roll in, a low down of 42 overnight. Tomorrow's weather, partly to mostly cloudy, a high of 59. We'll see clouds and rain over the weekend with highs in the mid-50s. Today in history, on this date in 1944, FDR won an unprecedented fourth term as President of the United States. The quote of the day is from FDR: "Keep your ideas high, keep both feet on the ground, and keep everlastingly at it. The American people have a good habit, the habit of going right ahead and accomplishing the impossible." In rural parts of America, abortion care can be 5 minutes away in places like Oregon and California, or 11 hours away for women in Texas. Here's more on the stories making news in rural America.
Abortion rights were on the ballot in 10 states, with rights protected in 7. But accessing reproductive health care has always been tougher for rural women. Daily Yonder data reporter Sarah Malott says since the Supreme Court ended the federal right to abortion 2 years ago, rural women who need reproductive care have had to go farther than their city peers.
The travel distance varies by state, with women in parts of rural Texas having to travel up to almost 800 miles to receive care.
An average rural woman now travels 160 miles to get the procedure, nearly 50 miles farther than in 2020.
Trigger laws in some states made abortion bans take effect immediately following the Dobbs decision, but in other states, access worsened over a number of months.
States with strict bans have the longest travel times, including Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, and Arkansas. Veterans who live in rural communities experience benefits, but also face challenges compared to those who live in cities. Anya Slepian has more.
Fitzgerald, Georgia resident Amanda Fleener is the caregiver for her husband, John, wounded in Iraq in 2006. Because there are few healthcare resources in their rural community, she regularly has to drive him 3 hours each way for medical care, and they've had to opt out of some treatments.
We had to ask ourselves, does the drive negate the value of having that treatment done?
But Fleener also says a rural setting can itself be healing for vets like her husband.
And if they can get away to a quieter place where they can hunt or fish or just find some solitude in nature, it goes a long way to help their mental health.
I'm Anya Slepian.
Everything old is new again, including an ancient way of fighting the wildfires made more common by climate change. Native Americans in the South practiced prescribed burning, and it was quickly adopted by early European settlers. In Texas, Borger Fire Department Wildland Coordinator Archie Stone says it's still useful there, where the La Nina weather pattern in the ocean pushes drier air toward Texas.
A lot has to do with that setup as far as out in the oceans go and how our weather patterns set up. Some winters are warmer and drier. Some winters we start seeing the moisture and they're pretty docile.
Finally, a small cure for our divisive politics. It's World Kindness Day, celebrated every November 13th to encourage random acts of goodwill toward individuals, communities, and the world at large.
Vice President Kamala Harris concedes but promises to fight on in a speech at Howard University. Republicans celebrate a possible red sweep, although a House majority is still uncertain, and a statehood mandate gains support in Puerto Rico. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
While I concede this election, I do not concede the fight that fueled this campaign.
An upbeat Vice President Kamala Harris addressed the nation from Howard University after calling now President-elect Donald Trump. While acknowledging that many Americans fear what's coming, she told supporters not to give up and vowed to keep fighting for reproductive rights, democracy, and the rule of law. The fight for the House isn't finished, but seems to be trending Republican, which could give Trump's party full control of Congress, as well as a conservative majority Supreme Court. Outgoing Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell congratulated Trump on the win.
I think it was a referendum on the current administration, in part. People were just not happy with this administration, and the Democratic nominee obviously was a part of it.
Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is calling out the Democratic Party for their lackluster performance and blames part of it on ignoring the priorities of the working class.
They know that there's something wrong when 60% of our people live in paycheck to paycheck.
Edward Mitchell of the Council on American Islamic Relations pointed to a loss of Democratic support among Muslim and others opposed to the Gaza war. He urged Trump to fulfill his campaign pledge to pursue peace.
We're happy to engage with President-elect Trump if he's doing the right thing and if he's doing something we think is wrong. We're happy to oppose him. That's our job.
Trump has said the war in Gaza wouldn't have happened if he were president, but also called on Israel to, quote, finish the job. Ballot measures to expand access to abortion won in 7 of the 10 states. In the case of Arizona, abortion up to fetal viability will now be a right under the state constitution. Undecided Arizona voter Bobby Hill told CNN abortion is important, but she questioned Harris's record on the issue.
I guess with her is, you've been in the office for 4 years. What have you done? You haven't done anything to benefit.
Former presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says he's ready to take a health policy role in a new Trump administration and says there are entire departments within the Food and Drug Administration that have to go.
In some categories of workers, there are entire departments like the nutrition departments at FDA that have to go, that are not doing their job. They're not protecting our kids.
The job of Health and Human Services Secretary requires Senate confirmation, which might be hard for Kennedy to get. He might take another position that doesn't require confirmation. Finally, Puerto Rico voters want the island's political status reconsidered. Nearly 60% voted for a ballot referendum on becoming a state. George Laws Garcia with the Puerto Rico Statehood Council says Puerto Ricans are American citizens, and Congress should see they want full democracy, federal voting rights, and equality.
The admission of Puerto Rico as a state of the Union would automatically fully enfranchise the U.S. citizens of Puerto Rico.
I'm Alex Gonzalez.
The first Alaska Native ever elected to Congress is still fighting for her job after the election. Mary Peltola, a Democrat, is just behind Nick Begich, a Republican in the race. Meantime, Davids wins her House seat for the fourth time. With these stories and more, here's Jill Freitas and National Native News.
In October, U.S. Representative Mary Peltola predicted that her race could come down to dozens of votes. So far, the margin isn't that close, but still pretty close. Peltola was the first Alaska Native to be elected to Congress. But as KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, the Democrat is trailing behind her Republican challenger, Nick Begich.
Alaskans expected Donald Trump to win their state. The question was, what would be the coattail effect for Nick Begich III? So far, he has just under half the vote, about 10,500 votes more than Mary Peltola. His uncle, former U.S. Senator Mark Begich, is a Democrat and supports Peltola. Although there's only about a dozen precincts left to count, these are in predominantly rural and Alaska Native communities, with votes likely to go to Peltola. Begich says although her path to victory is narrow, it's still there. He recalled election night in his own race in 2008 against the late Senator Ted Stevens.
Everyone counted me out. Even the senators counted me out back east, because I remember calling them. I mean, on my election against Ted Stevens, I was down 3,700 votes election night. And then I won by 3,800 votes.
Former state lawmaker Cherise Millett says she's hoping Peltola will pull through. Millett is an Inupiaq who served as Republican House Majority Leader.
We'll see. I mean, I'm hopeful. As a Native woman, I'd like to see Mary prevail.
But Millett says it won't be easy.
I think there's a path for her to prevail, but it's really an uphill battle. Everything and the stars have to align perfectly for her to prevail.
Begich needs more than 50% of the vote to avoid triggering the next step in Alaska's ranked choice voting system on November 20th. That's when the votes for the two other candidates in the race would be divvied up between Begich and Peltola, depending on who voters ranked as their second choice. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
It is another term for Congresswoman Charisse Davids from Kansas's 3rd District. Rhonda Lavaldo has more.
With her 4th victory, incumbent Charisse Davids, citizen of the Ho-Chunk Nation, won her re-election with 53% of the vote to Prasanth Reddy's 42%. Davids talked about the hurdles she overcame to get things done for Kansas.
We have been facing so many challenges, rising costs, divisiveness. There are things like attacks on our basic rights, things that have made the last few years not easy for a lot of folks. But through it all, we have seen people push forward, push toward real solutions, taking the commitment that we have to each other and our shared commitment for our state and our shared commitment for our country, and doing everything we can.
While the crowd watched the presidential election results, Haskell student Jacob Curtis, Cherokee citizen, talked about why he drove to Oklahoma to vote as a young person as the crowd cheered to incoming results.
I would say that it's important to vote, especially in your native communities.
At the end of David's speech, she stated there is more work to be done in the state of Kansas and hopes everyone can work together and get over the divisiveness. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 7, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Leuschner, Chris Goy, Suzanne Potter, and Althea Billings. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.